Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We're in an uncertain time with regard to healthcare. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has faced vehement opposition on Capitol Hill and from the White House. The potential new tax reform plan takes aim at some of the Affordable Care Act's bedrock principles, like the individual mandate, in which every American adult is required to purchase insurance on the open market if we aren't covered through our employers. The expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act has provided health insurance to 20 million previously uninsured Americans, but only in states that have accepted Medicaid expansion. Oklahoma, unfortunately, is not one of them. My guest today, Harold Pollack, is a public policy expert and has written and lectured about the benefits of Medicaid expansion. He also has a very personal experience with safety net programs like Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, as he and his wife Veronica care for her disabled brother, Vincent. Pollack is the Helen Ross Professor at the University of Chicago's School of Social Service Administration. He's also co-author of a book called The Index Card: Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. The book originated from his personal financial research that started when he and his wife assumed custodial care of Vincent. Pollack literally put 10 common sense simple rules for putting your finances in order on an index card, and his subsequent blog post about it went viral, featured in the Washington Post, Forbes, and eventually picked up by every major news source, including NPR and PBS. Harold Pollack, Helen Ross Professor at the University of Chicago, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Harold Pollack, welcome to the program. Let's start just by talking about Medicaid. And you've written and lectured about the concept of Medicaid for all, or using social insurance to reduce health disparities. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because we've had this expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which obviously is still somewhat of a political football, but you make a pretty cogent argument that this could be a bipartisan solution to addressing healthcare disparities.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing that, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it expanded health insurance in two ways. One was by expanding Medicaid to low-income people, and the second was through the marketplaces that allow people to buy private coverage and where low-income people get subsidies. And the way that it's played out, I think everybody assumed at the beginning that the Medicaid part would be pretty unpopular and that they wouldn't get any bipartisan support, but that the marketplaces, which are not so different from Medicare Advantage, would really be popular and people would love that, and it sort of combined Republican and Democratic ideas very effectively. And the way that it's played out has been really quite different, that in the states that expanded Medicaid, it turns out that the human experience of it is often better than what people found in the marketplaces, and that Democratic and Republican governors have really, whatever the ideological issues are, have really taken to Medicaid and are really using it to try to solve difficult problems like the opioid epidemic or problems of, really low-income people with mental health problems or leaving the criminal justice system. And that when the repeal and replace debate really came to a head, that Republican governors all over the United States said, don't mess with this. And Medicaid in its ACA expansion and also other parts of Medicaid for people with disabilities and other populations turned out to have tremendous bipartisan support. And in some ways, Medicaid may be the future of bipartisan health policy in a way that none of us would have really predicted in 2010.
So do you see states that have not expanded Medicaid coming aboard and doing so? Because, here in Oklahoma, we're one of the holdout states that has not expanded Medicaid, largely due to our governor and our legislators making the claim that they don't believe that the federal government will continue to fund it at that 90% or above level.
Yeah, it's sort of ironic that Republicans were making that argument, and then as soon as Republicans took power in Washington, they tried to cut that very reimbursement rate that they were worried about. So it's like we're really worried that someday we will win elections. I think eventually all the states will come in, including Oklahoma, and I think if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, that many of the Republican states that have been holdouts would have said, okay, we've made our point, we've fought about this long enough. I do think there has to be a give and take, and that one of the good things about having a Republican administration in Washington is that Republican governors can talk to someone from their own party and say, well, we want to expand Medicaid, but we want to do it in a Republican way, and let's talk about how to do that. And You know, of course, I happen to be a Democrat, and I wouldn't agree with all of the things that, that Oklahoma or Indiana or other states would want to do to expand Medicaid. But I kind of think that's the way the Democratic process works. You know, if Democrats don't like what Republican governors want to do with Medicaid, then we have to win elections. And I think that for these programs to be durable, both parties really do have to embrace them. And eventually that's going to happen in Medicaid. There's just, not only is there too much money on the table, but when you look at what Republican governors who did expand Medicaid, what they were able to accomplish, I think a lot of other Republicans around the country are saying, you know, we kind of need to do that. We have rural hospitals that we have to worry about. We have people with disabilities who need to be covered, who, for one reason or another, we need the expansion to help. And I'm optimistic that there's a consensus in America that everyone needs to have health insurance and that Medicaid really needs to be a part of that in some way.
So one of the purported plans, now obviously it's still being debated and legislated to some extent in conference committee, is this new tax plan. And I can't remember if it was the House version or the Senate version of the tax reform bill, but took away, I understand, the individual mandate. Are there other hidden sort of time bombs or things that are going to alter Medicaid policy in the tax plan that you know of?
Well, there's a couple of things in the new bill. There's also reducing the medical care deduction, which for people with chronic illnesses and really expensive health problems could be a problem. I think the really big issue with the tax bill is just it's going to hammer the deficit. And we know that after this is passed that, you know, way two clicks of the clock and then Republicans in Congress will say, you know, we have to reform entitlements because we have a big deficit problem. So I think the biggest worry is simply that it will put more fiscal pressure on the government. And no one exactly knows what's going to happen with this plan. It's so both the health care repeal and the tax bill are so poorly crafted in such a last minute way that I think both Democratic and Republican policymakers are just trying to figure out, you know, sort of what is this thing? And I don't think anyone's really provided a careful analysis of the long-term implications of it. So we should probably have a real sense of uncertainty about the ultimate implications.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Harold Pollack. He is the Helen Ross Professor, and he studies and writes about public policy at the University of Chicago's School of Social Service Administration. And Harold, you also have a couple of roles, a couple of different hats you wear. You direct, I think it's called the Crime Lab and also the Health Lab at the University of Chicago. Tell us about what those two labs do. And I guess if you wouldn't mind, I've heard about with the Health Lab, this program you have in supportive for release of people from the Cook County Jail, because mm-hmm. that's often a huge inflection point for people winding back up in the criminal justice system.
So I should say that I'm the Joe Biden of both the University of Chicago Crime Lab and the University of Chicago Health Lab. Jens Ludwig is the director of the Crime Lab, and David Meltzer is the director of the Health Lab. They're both two superstar researchers, and I'm delighted to be a colleague with both of them. We do randomized trials of violence prevention and social service interventions for severely vulnerable populations, and of course Chicago has so many challenges in these areas that we, right outside our door, we have a lot of challenge to work with. The Supportive Release Center is a health lab project that we're doing with local nonprofit partners who actually provide the services, where we try to help people when they're leaving the Cook County Jail. We have this challenge that you have, I should remind your listeners that there are jails and prisons. You know, if you get convicted of a felony, you go to prison, you stay there for a longer period of time, usually over a year, and there's a very predictable schedule by which you leave. People cycle through the jail. Often they're there for a night or two or a week, and they're kind of the urban rabble in a lot of cases. There's somebody who might be fighting with people, screaming at passersby. Maybe the person has a mental health or addiction issue. Maybe they've been shoplifting. And we have this challenge that somebody gets into the jail. They could leave there at 10:30 at night, 2 days after they've been admitted, and then what happens to them? Where do they go? You know, maybe they were staying at their girlfriend's, but whatever happened that, you know, put them in the jail, their girlfriend's not going to be delighted for them to come back and stay that night. And a lot of people with mental health issues or other life problems slip through our fingers and have, you know, some really bad outcome just at the moment when no one's really able to pay attention to them because they're, you know, maybe they have an appointment at the state mental, at the, you know, county hospital for a mental health visit that's been, you know, made by someone in the jail, but who's checking to see if they actually make that appointment, and all these kinds of issues. So what we do is we set up these trailers off the grounds of the jail where people can go. They can get three hots and a cot. There's case managers there. Someone can take them to their appointment the next day if they have an appointment. They're connected with a helping system. And it's a very lean intervention, but we're hoping to show that we can reduce homelessness, reduce subsequent rearrests by just making sure that we give good care for people just at this moment of maximum vulnerability.
That's really fascinating. So you had to get cooperation, obviously, from the city or the county or both in terms of putting those mobile units out there, right? And then how is that funded?
So we have philanthropic support, and we also have, you know, foundation support for the research. And we have a number of NIH grants that we are submitting to try to support this work as well. We have tremendous support from the Cook County Jail, from our nonprofit partners, Heartland Health Outreach and TASC, who are very experienced social service providers that provide the services. We have tremendous cooperation from the Chicago Police Department, with whom we have data sharing agreements so we can see who's rearrested, all those kinds of issues. There's a tremendous amount under the hood that goes into any of these interventions to make them even feasible. Everyone involved in it is so gratified by the importance of what we're trying to do. You know, you don't want to oversell anything like this. It's not the polio vaccine, but we think we're really trying to deal with some really significant issues for you know, these really vulnerable populations that go through the jail and that just desperately need addiction and mental health services and housing supports and other help so that they can be more functional and you know, more successful in their lives.
So I want to ask you one other question related to crime or to law enforcement particularly, which is, and I've seen you quoted about this in various Chicago-related publications. This is an issue for us in Tulsa, too, which is that law enforcement will come into contact with people who have a severe mental illness, who may be agitated or not on their medication. And unfortunately, in spite of best intentions, sometimes this results in poor outcomes, like even death or, you know, a shooting. So Chicago, I think, is doing something that we've seen here in Tulsa that has just started this past summer, crisis intervention teams, where we're doing more training for police officers in mental health. And I guess, what's your work in this area, or what's Chicago doing?
So Chicago faces significant challenges with people in behavioral crises. And as I'm sure it's also true in Tulsa, you have someone calls 911, says, my son's really out of control. And the officers arrive on the scene. They are not psychiatrists. They are not, mental health professionals. And they have to somehow keep everybody safe and deal with a person who might be in behavioral crisis, you know, in whatever the situation is. And we've had tragedies here in Chicago and across the country where people can end up being shot or officers are hurt or family members are hurt in situations where we think that if police got improved training, that they would be more likely to navigate those situations successfully. So crisis intervention teams really involve a set of de-escalation methods, and time and distance and cover are kind of the three basic principles that officers try to follow. And, you know, you encounter someone who is very agitated. The first thing you do is you want to give them the time to calm down. And you want to keep them away from you and from other people so that you minimize the prospects of some sort of altercation. And very often, if you can do those time and distance things, you can get more help from people who have more training. Maybe someone who knows that person can come and help calm them down. They will anything that avoids having to put your hand on that person. After which whatever can happen, you know, can happen. It turns out that those principles are very, very valuable, and that we're trying in Chicago. They're training more and more officers to have CIT skills, and across the country that's being done. And there's a lot of potential with that. So many of the cases where something horrible happens to a person in behavioral crisis, it was the fundamental error was somehow, you know, you'll see, you ever see like a 2-minute cell phone video where someone ends up getting shot, something like that? Usually the fundamental error happened before the video was turned on. You know, it was basically in the 5 minutes before, when they had an opportunity to de-escalate the situation, they somehow weren't able to do so. And I must say, I really feel for police. You know, we really dump on police the responsibility to handle, you know, whatever comes through the 911 system. Same is true of ambulance, you know, EMTs and others, that we expect them to be our mental health system. We expect them to be our, you know, emergency medical system. We expect them to deal with violent criminals. We expect so much of law enforcement. And that's really hard. And the CIT is a set of tools that turns out to be very useful in that moment to help de-escalate that situation. I should say that I take care of someone who's intellectually disabled, who's a 260-pound man. Also, people with intellectual disabilities also require officers sometimes to have this type of training because they also come into contact with law enforcement if they're behaving in a way that is of concern to the people around them in their lives.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Harold Pollack. He's the Helen Ross Professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. And Harold, you mentioned that you care for someone with intellectual disabilities, and this kind of ties our conversation back to the starting point, which is Medicaid. This is your brother-in-law, Vincent.
Yes.
Tell us about how you came to care, you and your wife came to care for Vincent, and then what path that led you down.
So, yeah, this was a life-changing event for me. I was a professor at the University of Michigan for 7 years, and then I was offered a tenured position at the University of Chicago. And so I moved to Chicago, and a couple of months after we got here, my mother-in-law, tragically, she died suddenly, and her son, my brother-in-law, Vincent, had to move into our home. He had been living, my mother-in-law lived in upstate New York, in Oneonta, New York, and we had to just, you know, take Vincent and move him into the guest room of our house. And we had two young daughters at the time, and Vincent was 340 pounds. He lives with a condition known as Fragile X syndrome. He had a series of medical challenges, and he also had to find a new place for him to spend the day. He had been going to a sheltered workshop, and we had to figure out how to deal with his medical needs when we crossed the state boundary. So he was disenrolled in New York State Medicaid, and it was a life. It's a life-changing event for our family, particularly for my wife, Veronica, who really assumed daily responsibility for his care when he moved into our home.
And if I remember correctly, she actually wound up having to give up her employment in order because his caregiving needs, you know, required so much time. And this really did put you in somewhat of a financial pickle because here you had just come to University of Chicago as a newly tenured professor, as you said, but then had this big financial hit. And as you point out, he had been on New York Medicaid, but that did not cover him in Illinois, so he had to get on Illinois Medicaid. So here you are, this policy expert who writes and thinks about public policy and Medicaid, but now you were having a very personal experience in facing it, and you write beautifully about this, you and Veronica both, in Health Affairs, in a what I saw was a 2006 article about the challenges you faced in accessing the social safety net for someone who with these challenges like Vincent.
Yeah, we had, particularly the first 6 months that he was living with us, were really quite difficult. And it was a very humbling experience because certainly my Medicaid policy expertise, when I actually tried to convert that into actually knowing what I was doing on a day-to-day basis to help my own family, turned out to be surprisingly limited. And on every front, we were challenged. And, you know, one thing was I really thought we were just going to hemorrhage out our money. When Vincent moved in, as I said, he was, you know, a very large person, and one of the things we needed to do was to buy new furniture so that he could sit comfortably, you know, without breaking our furniture. And I remember buying a Lazy Boy chair, and it was something like $900 something that he was really comfortable to sit in. And I remember thinking, like, I'm just going to burn through, all my money. And That actually didn't happen, as it turned out. You know, Medicare and Medicaid and his Social Security, you know, really saved us. You know, he was getting $1,100 a month from Social Security as a survivor based on his father's work history. And, God, that was just a godsend. Even as a University of Chicago professor, boy, we really needed that in that moment. And it was very difficult to get him connected to Medicaid, and there's a lot that's wrong with Medicaid. But he's been hospitalized many times since he's come here, and I must say that Medicare and Medicaid together have paid, they really have paid for everything that he needed, and not always, you know, without a little bit of drama. But I must say that the experience has actually been better, I think, than if he had been on private insurance. You know, we just don't have all the hassles that we experience with our own health care when we get, you know, weird paperwork from our insurers and things like that. It's actually something that I'm incredibly grateful for. And I think that we all, these programs are there so that we can all protect each other against these risks that would just crush any one of us if we had to face them on our own. And I just think that's so important.
Well, so it was your personal research led you down this rabbit hole, which turned out to be kind of beneficial, which was you were never someone who'd spent a lot of time thinking about your personal finances. As you point out, you were, you know, like many academics, spent many years in the academy and didn't really think through your retirement benefit choices and things like that. And suddenly, literally, your brother-in-law, this quite heavy brother-in-law, was dropped into your life and you were worried about bankruptcy. So you eventually, through your personal research, came up with this. You did enough research to figure out that really common sense and basic financial advice could really fit on one index card, a 3x5 index card, as you boasted, and then eventually were challenged to produce, which turned into a book, the index card.
Yeah, it is such a life has so many weird turns. So I had completely been lackadaisical about personal finance up until that point, and I figured I'd get tenure someday. You know, I didn't have to worry about it too much and had very little savings. And in fact, when I moved to University of Chicago, I wanted to buy a home, and I had no savings for my home. And the university helped me with the down payment, and they also connected me with a banker. And I walked into I talked to the banker, and I said, I want to buy this, you know, very ambitious plan, you know, to buy my house and all these things that I wanted. And at some point, and I was in that, I've just been tenured, don't you know who I am, complete ego rush phase of life that academics can go through. And at some point, I took a breath, and the gentleman that I was talking to said, Mr. Pollack, I just have to tell you that you're not a good customer. And the fact that you're 40 years old, and you have basically none of your own money to buy this home, is we regard that as problematic. And you know, if you left the University of Chicago, they would want the money back that they're providing to help with your down payment. And you know, I'm talking to you because the University of Chicago is an important client of mine, and I, you know, so I'm talking to you, but you have to understand, you got to really dial it back. And I was very offended. I was a little curt with this gentleman. I actually found another mortgage broker and got a loan less than what I had planned on. And wow, that saved me when we had this financial crisis, that we had a relatively inexpensive home. And I decided this gentleman that I talked to was the most honest financial professional that I had ever dealt with, even though I was mean to him at the time. But I became obsessed with saving and investing and what people should do. And I quickly found, when I started to really research it, that the expert conversation was really quite simple. As you said, that there's, you know, don't buy or sell any individual stocks, maximize your 401k, all this kind of stuff that's really very simple. One day I was interviewing a personal finance writer named Helene Owen, and as we were talking about her work, I just casually said, you know, isn't the problem that the personal finance industry faces, you know, isn't there a fundamental problem that you could just get for free, you know, the best advice from the library, and it would fit on an index card? And we kind of laughed about it, and then I started getting emails from people saying, well, where's the index card? And, you know, and of course, I was kind of stuck because I was just yucking it up, you know, with somebody and making a joke. But I put my flag in the ground, so I grabbed one of my daughter's 4x6 index cards from the drawer, and I scribbled 9 rules down in maybe 2 minutes, and I took a picture with my iPhone, and I posted it. and it got 400,000 hits on the web.
Oh, my goodness.
And, in fact, it won one of Money Magazine's Best New Ideas of the Year. And, like, all my friends at the University of Chicago who are, like, you know, real financial experts, they're all like, you're kidding. Because it was all like, pay your credit card in full at the end of the month, things like that. You know, there's no new idea there that, that had any profundity to it whatsoever. You know, save your money. I said save 20% of your money, and I had a set of rules. But there was something about that index card that people found really helpful. They could put it on their refrigerator, that it kind of took this really forbidding financial task and said, all I have to do is, I don't have to understand everything, I just have to follow what's on this card. That seemed to be really powerful for people. And Helene and I actually went and wrote a book. And it's been, people have, you know, found it very helpful, where we just lay out the basics of, how do I know when I'm ready to buy a home? How do I think about, you know, investing in my retirement account? It's sort of the not fancy stuff that most people face as they try to methodically save and invest for their future. And it's I'm probably more known for that index card than almost anything else that I've done in my career, which is the way that life throws up unexpected turns for everybody.
Well, it's a delightful book, and it's chock full of good humor, kind of like the way you come across in an interview here. And rule number 10 here in the book version is remember the index card. So when all else fails, stick to the methodology of keeping it simple, right? That's what's the allure, the file card with your handwriting and keeping it simple. And it really is, it's the kind of book I want my kids to read, you know, just sort of like very common sense advice from a parent to a child, or, you know, you'd think maybe a eighth or ninth grade classroom of kids trying to like understand personal finance at some point.
Well, thank you. I hope it's helpful. I'm not the world's best role model of succeeding in every aspect of, you know, personal financial management or anything of the sort. And I think that maybe that's one reason why people were drawn to the book, because it kind of, I'm a flawed human being in this realm and made a lot of mistakes that, as many of us have.
Well, the book is great. I can't recommend it enough. But I also, your work in at the nexus of public policy, healthcare, and criminal policy as well, really is fascinating work, and a lot to learn from my guest today, Harold Pollack, who is the Helen Ross Professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. Harold Pollack, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I must say, I have tremendous respect for what people have accomplished in Oklahoma, in preschool work, in a lot of areas. And we certainly learn from you in Illinois. And we watch the high quality of governance and the things that are going really well in a place like Oklahoma. And I hope that Oklahoma expands its Medicaid program, because that's so important. But, you know, we have tremendous respect for what people are accomplishing, sometimes in a real challenging circumstance in a state, like your own.
Well, thanks so much. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.